The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 56. Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show. All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to bring someone to the Rebel Capitalist Show that I have a tremendous amount of respect for. He is nice enough to have me on his show. He is a media insider and award-winning journalist. Guys, his name is Rick Sanchez. Rick, thanks for being on the Rebel Capitalist Show.
That's great, George. Thanks for having me on. It's a pleasure. It's an honor, actually. An honor more than a pleasure.
Well, we won't go there yet. But for those of my viewers who might not know your backstory, can you go ahead and get us up to speed there?
Boy, Cuban kid, grew up in Cuba, was born in Cuba, came over during the revolution. My parents were really poor, maybe $11,000 a year combined income. They were great, loving parents, made me study, did very well in school. I was a pretty good football player, too, so I got a journalism scholarship, went to Minnesota. That eventually turned into a CBS News journalism scholarship to go into broadcast news. At the time, there wasn't anybody like me in broadcast news. Some would argue there still aren't a lot of people like me in broadcast news, and maybe good or bad. So I went into television news, started at the local level, and we just killed it. We had the highest rated local newscast in the entire United States. It was called WSVN. We created the format that was later copied by other television stations and networks. Then NBC came and gave me more money than I could say no to. So I went and worked at in New York at NBC as a journalist and as an anchor. Then after NBC, I switched over to CNN. Did very well there. I was the first person, so says the New York Times, to establish this thing where I married social media with contemporary journalism and content gathering at the time. And it became like this huge hit, and it was associated with my identity and my name and cool like that.
What
that
year was that, Rick?
That was probably 2006, around there, 2006, okay. 2007, 2000. It's when Twitter first came out, and I took it, incorporated it into our broadcast with a fellow named John Klein, who at the time was the president of CNN. I had the highest rated shows on all of CNN and was doing very well. And then I did an interview where I screwed up, mangled my words. They got pissed off, so they fired me. Went back to Miami and said, okay, I guess I got to figure out a way to make another, you know, to make that kind of money, you know, whatever it was, that was pretty good dough. And so I did something kind of cool. I triangulated myself. I said, well, everybody in South Florida knows who I am, so I have my brand, and I understand advertising. Why don't I do this? I think this is a lesson for everybody out there who doesn't realize sometimes the power of their own brand, no matter what they know or their skill set. And I said, what if I take my brand, give it to a television station who needs ratings and needs advertisers, but rather than just do a show and have them get the advertisers, I'm going to hook up with an advertiser. And I hooked up with some doctors and we created a healthcare company. I was one of the owners of that healthcare company. And we triangulated a deal where I produced a show for the television station that bumped their ratings. In return, they gave us a share of their advertising inventory, which I then placed in my company to propagate a way of getting people to sign on. And lo and behold, Inc. Magazine just called our company the fastest growing healthcare company in America. Yeah. And it happened over 4.5-5 years. Pretty cool.
Very cool.
Then Fox News hired me. I'm almost done. It gets crazy. But then Fox News hired me. And then as I was doing my life in Miami, all of a sudden I get a call one day from an agent. And he said, how'd you like to get back in the business at the national level? I said, no, I'm out. I'm done. I'm doing great. I'm happy. He goes, I don't know. These guys really want to talk to you. So I said, fine. So I flew in, talked to them. And at first I said, Russians? Hell no. Then I talked to them and I realized what they would offer me, and they're great, super fantastic, cool guys. What they offered me was an opportunity to be transparent, have journalistic independence, almost at a level that doesn't exist today if I was to work for one of their competitors here, because it's more of a global newscast. Really good show. If nobody's watched it, you should. RT America. But they gave me an opportunity to do things that I think can't be done today on the CNNs and the Foxes and the MSNBCs and the ABCs, et cetera, the traditional corporate establishment media, for reasons that we can get into. And that's pretty much my story.
Yeah, really cool. Really cool. I don't know if you know this, but I did a TV show here in Medellin before I got into YouTube. It had the exact same business model, but we can talk about that later. So you said that now with RT, it's fantastic because they give you a lot of freedom, a lot of wiggle room to be independent that you wouldn't otherwise have. So can you explain what that wiggle room is? Maybe give us some examples and then explain why that wouldn't be possible on another network, like a mainstream network.
There's two parts to that answer. And the first one is, follow along here. There was a time in television news in America where it was essentially run by journalists.
Right.
And the owners were respectful of news gathering, content creation, get down in the dirt and look for good stories and speak truth to power. And in fact, if you can comfort the afflicted and afflict the powerful, you're doing a good job, because that's really what journalism is, right? And the people who were on the air were real journalists, people like myself, who went to the Eric Severide School of Journalism at the University of Minnesota and have a journalism degree and have practiced journalism all of their lives. Something happened in the last, I guess, decade or so, where if you turn on one of those networks today, what you'll notice is it's generally a group of people who are not journalists by any stretch of the imagination, talking to other people who belong to a class called punditry. And the topic is always political. So what they do is, and that's why they've hired, and if you turn on any of these networks today, you find people who are lawyers and ex-politicians and people in the Reagan administration and the Trump administration, the Bush administration, the Obama administration, they're the stars now of television. People inside the establishment who are either the anchors or the pundits who sit around talking all the time. So what they do is they put, what do they know? What do they know? I'll tell you what they know. They know politics. That's all they know. So along comes a story, for example, now like the coronavirus. It's a real legitimate story. Suddenly you have to go back to the essence of journalism, the five W's, ask the questions, find things out. They don't know how to do that. They've never done that. They have been paid for the last 10 years to sit there on any one of these networks and just gab for 24 hours about, you know, what did Nancy do and what did Donald do and what did Biden do and what did Obama do and why do you like him and why does she hate him and why does he hate her? And it's like, it's this constant conversation about the ebb and flow of political, gabbing. And
it has
nothing to do with journalism. It has nothing, yeah. Exactly. In many ways, it's almost like a
soap opera.
Yeah, reality show, soap opera comes to mind, those kinds of things, which, by the way, is interesting. Sometimes it's fun to watch. Whether you're looking at it from the right, you could sit there and watch Fox blast, Hillary and Obama, or you could sit there and watch MSNBC blast, Donald Trump and the Republicans. Great, find your audience and it's fun. But it has nothing the hell to do with journalism. And I think that's one of the problems with where we are right now, that we've lost that in a very large way. And I think that's kind of hurt the profession.
Yeah. And, another problem I see, and maybe you can expand on this, is that journalism has a very good reputation. If you go back to the 1960s, the 1970s, the 1980s, I mean, these are people that we really looked up to because they were trying to get to the truth. So it's almost like the journalists of today, fake journalists that you're talking about, they've ridden the wave, or they're still riding the coattails of that brand. And people still see these people as journalists, but they don't know that they're just creating entertainment. And isn't that kind of dangerous if they see it as journalism trying to get to the truth? But in reality, it's entertainment. So it would almost be like watching a World Wrestling Federation, wrestling back when I was a kid, and not understanding that, that's actually really fake and thinking that it's real. But now we're doing that at an adult level with things that are really, really important.
And some of them, by the way, not to disparage, you know, the broad brush approach on this, some of them are journalists. Some of them are actually damn good journalists who have lost their way because of the second element of what I'm about to explain to you.
Okay.
Somewhere along the line, journalistic entities, major newspapers, you know, television stations at the local level, networks, were owned by people whose business was journalism. In other words, the guy who owned your local newspaper in Wichita was a guy who grew up in a family where he essentially had his great-grandfather bought the newspaper, started the newspaper, and that was their business. Somewhere along the line, the business model in the United States became, the journalistic business model became completely corporatized. So suddenly the people who own journalism are the people who journalists are supposed to be going after. The people who we should question, the, you know, I'll give you a perfect example. When I was first hired at NBC and I got up there, 9/11 happened. I remember I was there. I was one of the only reporters actually reporting live, and I saw the building fall and the people fall, and it was horrible. So, but I remember immediately after we went back, I started thinking, and I was talking to Lester Holt, who was my buddy back then, who's now the main anchor at NBC. And he and I, remember, once looked at each other and said, what the hell is going on here? Why are we being encouraged to push this war on Iraq when Iraq did not attack us? We were attacked, obviously, by factions inside Afghanistan. You know, if you do the whole Al-Qaeda and the Muslim Brotherhood and you do the whole thing. And that's where the problem is. Why are we suddenly promulgating this war against Iraq? And then we started realizing at the time that we were working for a company, at least I did, I don't want to put words in Lester's mouth. We were working at the time for General Electric, which was the company which was going to make the most amount of money from the war in Iraq, because they were weapons manufacturers who happened to also own MSNBC. And what we're seeing now in the journalism industry is that type of interlocking connection between people who sit on the boards of NBC, CNN, Fox News, New York Times, you go right down your list, who have interests in telling certain stories and having certain stories not told by these people who they pay very well, by the way, millions of dollars to be the circus show of what's going on in the world. So that in and of itself makes it difficult then for that journalist who, by the way, has four kids and a wife or a husband or whatever they have in their family. They're making $2, $3, $4, $5, $6 million being the face, one of the faces of one of these networks. And all they have to do is kind of look the other way when the United States, you know, invades Honduras under the auspices of Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, or look the other way when we put sanctions on Venezuela. And, you know, the guy who may be the president of Venezuela may be a complete moron and an idiot, but he's their moron and he's their idiot, and they elected him. So, but we don't question that anymore. Whereas 20, 30 years ago, we would have been questioning the Vietnam War. Today, everything our government does is fine. Just this last week, there was a journalist during the White House briefing who was literally arguing with the president of the United States, President Trump of all people, because President Trump was saying, look, if the Russians want to give aid to the Italians and the Italians want to take something from China and China wants to give us whatever they want to give us, that's good. And the journalist was like, no, they're bad countries. We need to attack them and criticize them. And I was going, what the hell happened? Am I in a Fellini movie? It used to be that journalists, George, right, would argue with politicians who tended to be overly aggressive warmongers. Today, even when politicians don't want to be overly aggressive warmongers, the journalists are pushing them in that direction. What the hell happened? And that's kind of the, maybe the best way to describe what's happened over the last 10 or 15 years in journalism.
Let me try to unpack that a little bit, because in my mind, I saw it as you've got a particular media outlet that says, okay, guys, we've got to get ratings to exist. We have to get eyeballs. So it's going to be in our best interest to pick a side. Either we're going to pick the left or we're going to pick the right, and we're going to stand our ground. And that's the side, that's the demographic that we're going to cater to in order to get as many eyeballs as we possibly can. But it sounds, and that's what I thought was the main motivation, but it sounds like from what you're saying that it could be a lot greater than that. As an example, I'm And I'm not saying this is what's happening, but I'm big corporation XYZ, and I benefit from there being a war in Iraq. And I'm going to go ahead and buy this media network almost as a loss leader. And I don't care if they make money. I don't care if they who cares? Because to me, it's just pennies where I'm going after the dollars. And I know that that's a way that I can achieve my objectives and make, call it billions and billions of dollars, when all I have to do is just spend, you know, $200 or $300 million. Is that what I'm hearing?
If nothing else, you're absolutely right. And if nothing else, that lost leader is a wonderful branding exercise for your company. Right. So you're buying a journalism entity when journalism entities are rock bottom viable because they're not in demand, so they're cheap. We can pick it up for almost nothing, i.e. Amazon, Washington Post. It makes you look good, it cleans you, and you have what is potentially, if nothing else, a branding vehicle for yourself and for your company, which is brilliant, but it's not good for the viewers, for the consumers of content, for the consumers of news, which is why suddenly the opening comes along and people like George Gammon are suddenly very popular on the Googles, on the YouTubes, because people are going, well, wait a minute, if I watch CNN or Fox or these other guys, I get very establishment, you know, content, which I know has its limits and can't go outside the box. If I watch this guy, he doesn't have those parameters, so he's allowed to tell me things. He may be full of crap too, but somehow I kind of want to trust this guy a little more. I think he may have more credibility than those guys. But wait a minute, those guys are sitting in Walter Cronkite's chair. What happened? Well, it happened. And suddenly George Gammon has more in common than Walter Cronkite than the guys who are sitting in the chairs that Walter Cronkite used to occupy. And sadly, that's the case right now, which is why a guy like Donald Trump can come along and tell everybody, there is no truth. Those guys are lying. Those guys are lying. It's all up in the air. I understand your problems. Trust me. Vote for me. And they did.
Right. But and then going back to that brand that journalists had, it's weird that you know, if you did a poll of 100 Americans or 10,000 Americans, I'll bet, you know, 90% of them or whatever would say, do you trust XYZ mainstream media outlet that they're telling us? They say, no. But sure enough, when they watch a certain segment of the news, whether it's on the left or the right, and that confirms their narrative that's in their head, then they believe it as its absolute truth. So my next question would be, do you get a little concerned from the standpoint of the average viewer that they're just getting in this echo chamber where all they watch is maybe just MSNBC, and that's all they subscribe to on Twitter and Facebook and the YouTube channel? So that's all the content that they're getting, and it puts them into this mindset or this tunnel vision that maybe they're getting the truth, but maybe they're not, especially in a day and age when it's all about entertainment and a corporate loss leader than it is about finding the actual truth.
Yeah, unfortunately, we do live two explanations for that. And I think one of them has to do with our political system having only two choices, which is, you know, obviously a huge problem where people have to decide whether they're Democrat or Republican. Oh, I'm Republican, I have to watch Fox News. Oh, I'm Democrat, I have to watch MSNBC, and both of them are full of shit. So in the end, so that's part of the problem, and our political system has created that. And that's horrible, because there's guys like you and me who know that sometimes the truth is on Fox and sometimes the truth is on MSNBC and sometimes neither one of them knows what the hell they're talking about. Right. And I think that's the way Americans need to think and will think in the future. The problem right now is the delivery system that we have for the average American. And, you know, maybe the coronavirus situation might change this, but the delivery system we have for news consuming in the United States of America right now is one that is easiest and somewhat cheapest by those who have the large corporate entities. So it's real easy for the average person to come home. And these are the people who vote, by the way. Yeah. People over the who watches CNN, who watches Fox News, who watches nightly news. You know, God bless them, people who are very close to death. And maybe 10 years, 15 years younger than them. So start maybe around 65 to 80 are the people who live there. But those are also the people who vote. And those are in many ways the people who are most involved in the political system. So what's easy for them? You come home, you sit on the couch, you turn on your favorite cable channel, and you watch it. Now we're starting to see the proliferation of people going to YouTube and going to other places and starting to get different opinions. But, you know, just because you and I know that's happening, George, doesn't mean it's actually become reality yet. I think we're still probably 5 or 10 years away from that reality actually becoming the status quo. I think the election of Donald Trump was the first sign of people saying to the establishment, and by establishment I mean to the Democrats, to the liberals, to the conservatives, to the Republicans, go to hell. We think you're both full of crap. We're going to vote for this guy because he thinks you're both full of crap. So that may have been the first sign of it. That's not to say that, you know, our president is not in many ways full of crap, but he certainly messaged in such a way that set the hook to create that expectation.
So where I'm sure what's going on in the mind of my viewer right now is, okay, I get it, how it's all about corporations, or it's all about bias on one end of the political spectrum. So if I'm just the average Joe or Jane that's trying to find the truth, how do I it's like I'm a ping pong ball just going back and forth and back and forth. Obviously there's your show, there's RT, there's some independents, there's some maybe some groups on YouTube, but from your standpoint, what would you suggest? How do they find the truth, like whether it's the coronavirus or what's going on in the Middle East or any of these big issues we have? How do people actually get the facts?
You know, that's an interesting question. By the way, it's funny, one of the comments that's most prolific when I go to YouTube and see what people are writing about me is, damn it, Sanchez, I can't believe I have to go to Russian TV to get the truth about my country.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's like, we go in there every night and we create a newscast, which I put I throw myself into to make sure, and I'm not saying it's perfect, I'm as imperfect as anybody, but that, you know, we're really trying to tell both sides, give information that's usable. Sometimes we get it wrong, but at least we're trying to make the effort, and we're not getting, you know, major corporations like Disney or, you know, GE or Amazon telling me what I have to say. So it's always cool to know where the filter might be. So as a consumer, the advice I would give to people is, when you watch somebody, listen for clues that tell you that, for example, let's make you a progressive. You're liberal. You love MSNBC because you're liberal. I have to watch Rachel Maddow and these people. But then you ask yourself, how come they didn't tell me about this? Or why are they pushing the United States to go to war in Venezuela? I thought they were progressive. Why are they doing that? Or why are they? So you have to ask yourself as a news consumer, not just what they're telling you, but what they're not telling you. Because more often than not, it's what they don't tell you where you find out what their real bias is. And I think moving forward, I've just going to finish with this. I've stopped watching the establishment news media. I just stopped watching them altogether. I don't think there's enough. There are nuggets of truth, nuggets of good moments and coverage, because they have the tools to take you to a place where something is happening, and then you get to see a live feed of a fire, a volcano exploding or something. But in terms of their opinions, their narrative, I stay the hell away from it because I know it's biased and I don't believe it. I'm looking now for people like you, maybe perhaps people like me, who are more independent and finding them in other vehicles that aren't regular commercial television.
Yeah, got it. So the takeaway there from what I'm hearing is just look at what your core principles are and what your belief system is and what you think the core principles of the newscast or the newscaster. And then is there something there that's not jiving? Like if your core principle is for freedom of speech and you're a liberal, let's say, and all of a sudden you've got Rachel Maddow or this person talking about how we shouldn't allow free speech for this entity, and that should be a red flag right there.
I think the better example for your listeners, viewers, is probably CNBC, right?
Yeah.
So right. CNBC, for people who love George because I know people may dabble on CNBC, then come back to George, and it's two completely different messages. There's no question that CNBC does a really good job bringing you up to date on all the stuff. If you want to know what's going on in the Dow, you want to know what's going on with all the different metrics in the economy, they're a good place to go. But now listen to what they say. Listen to Cramer. Listen to these guys. And you'll hear a drumbeat of establishment support where they're not questioning enough, at least, what the Fed does and the inherent reasons the Fed is doing what it's doing and what effect it's going to have on your life. Because to a certain extent, they know they are there to cheerlead for the Fed and cheerlead for the establishment and cheerlead for those corporations. So then ask yourself, yeah, I'm going to turn over to CNBC to find out what the numbers are. But I'm not going to rely on CNBC to create a narrative in my head, because they're going to be full of crap. Because I know what they have to do. Those are the pressures on a guy like Cramer, who may be making, for all I know, $15 million a year. That's a hell of a lot of money to suddenly not be promulgating the narrative that those people who are giving you the $15 million, you know, don't want you to say.
Right.
Common sense. Common sense. Right.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. And it's just the light bulb was going off in my head as well. So I appreciate the conversation. So I know we're limited on time, Rick. So let me just save my a couple more questions here for you.
Sure.
I think we've looked at it from the tops down. So we see the corporate level and how it kind of interacts with the bias. But from a bottoms up approach, how does that work on a daily basis when you're one of these people, pundits we'll call them, that works for either this left or right mainstream media outlet? When you come in there in the morning, I mean, do they specifically tell you, hey, listen, you need to talk well about this company, or taking it back to CNBC, or hey, we need to be bullish today, or hey, we need to find a bright spot in the fact that the Fed is blowing up all these asset bubbles? I mean, how does it work at that level?
It goes beyond that, actually. And maybe you're going to find this intriguing, but there's a couple of answers to that. One is they do a thing called pre-interviewing their guests. So today you and I are having this conversation. You and I have never even met before, other than the fact that I had you on my show for 4 minutes before. So you didn't have a team of bookers call Rick Sanchez and say, George is going to ask you these questions. What are you going to say? And then based on what I say, suddenly I get a call 5 minutes before air. Oh, sorry, Rick, we canceled you. There was a volcano in Tegucigalpa, right?
Okay.
So that's what they do. Number two, they pay them a pretty good nut, sometimes $250,000, $300,000 just to be on retainer, so that they're committed to that network, say MSNBC, CNN, or Fox. So their guests are paid as contributors owned by the networks.
Okay, got it.
So they're giving them a reason to stick around. Number three, many of those guests have relationships that you're not told about with corporations who they're also promulgating the message of. So let's say guest X is coming on today to talk about the situation between Iran and the United States. Little do you know that that guy is on the board of Raytheon. So that guy is going to have a tendency to want to continue the aggression, but you don't know that. So those are the three reasons that those people, those pundits that we think they just grabbed who are walking down the street and are fair and honest and balanced, no, they're not. And for the three reasons that I just stated, they've got their own story that they're trying to put out there.
And how does ownership or management communicate what the intended message or the intended narrative is to the actual people that work there on a daily basis, like CNBC, like a Steve Leisman or so? I don't want to throw him under the bus because I don't know him. He's a great guy. But let's just assume he's the
smart
type.
Smart guy, too. Whenever I see him, it seems like he's super smart. Yeah.
Yeah, but he's definitely pro-Fed.
Correct.
So, is that something where you think he himself believes that, or it's something where management is like, Steve, we really need someone to be pro-Fed, so you need to play that character?
Yeah, you know, you can't really get into one person's head.
Right.
So, you know, but the two things that come into play in a situation like that, and one is the fact that they don't have to tell you. They don't have to tell you because you know what the message is where you work. And you're smart enough to understand what happens to people who don't follow that message, because they get fired, they get released, their contracts aren't extended, or suddenly they don't get called on. Like we have, let's say, 10 contributors, and eight of them are getting on the air all the time, and two of them suddenly they, you know, maybe they get on once a month. Oh, by the way, and when they do come on, it's Saturday morning at 8 a.m. Who the hell's watching television Saturday morning at 8 a.m.?
Right.
So, right. You know, start seeing somebody who goes on the air and says something which doesn't fit the narrative of that particular network. And suddenly they either A, disappear, or B, they're showing up at really odd hours on unwatched shows. That is how they send the message to everybody else. If you do that, that's what's going to happen to you.
Got it. Got it. Okay. So last question here. You've been a pioneer in the media space and journalism. Where do you see this going in the next, call it 3 years, 5 years, 10 years?
Well, you know, I wonder if the situation we're all in now with the cerveza sickness, to steal a coined phrase, causing more and more people to suddenly sit at home and stream, whether that might have the same lasting effect on viewership and content consumption that I think one of your guests in one of your last segments was saying, I think it's Hartman, right? Was yep. saying about how people are going to move to the out of the big cities right. and back into the suburbs, right? Because this will have a lasting effect. More people will work from home. I think we might see more people now sampling George Gammon and sampling everything else that may be on YouTube and finding different ways of creating or consuming content. And that could have a lasting effect. It may be 20%, 30%. The other part of it is pretty obvious. And, you know, unfortunately, the people who are going to perish or as a result of the corona sickness are people who are older. And that is the consumer that lives off of that framework that I just described for you. So there are reasons to think that it will switch over the next year and we will get more people going to entities that are less controlled and less biased. And hopefully that will create a more independent spirit in our country, because right now we're locked into this mentality that's being pushed upon us where you have to be a conservative or you have to be a liberal or you have to be a Democrat and you have to be a Republican. And I don't think that's healthy. And in the end, it's too easy to control. And the people who know how to control it are doing a damn good job of it.
Yeah. All right. Well, Rick Sanchez, thank you very much for taking the time out. It's opened my eyes, and I'm sure everyone that watches this is really going to love it. So for my viewers who want to check out what you do, where can they go to see you? What time are you on? How do they get that information?
Yeah, sure. No, it's great. I do a newscast every single night normally. Right now there are more of them, but I do a newscast every single night at 7 and 8 p.m. It's called The News with Rick Sanchez. It really is very different, and they could also see it on something called Portable TV. Portable TV is a brand new streaming network that we just started that allows people to watch everything that I do at any time by just having it and clicking it, and it comes on, and there's no fee and all that other stuff. So, you know, subscribe to Portable TV, and you'll see me there.
All right, Rick. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Can't wait to do it again.
You're great, George. I'm going to have you on my show again, okay?
Can't wait.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.